We get things underway this afternoon by helping us, put the pieces together of this crazy American puzzle as we're joined by writer David Roth. How are you this afternoon, David?
Oh, you know, better than I was a couple days ago, I guess. How are you holding up?
I guess that's the same. But trying to take it a day at a time, and you wake up in the morning sort of afraid to go online and see what's happened since I closed my eyes the previous night.
Yeah, been a lot of that here, and it's strange. My days have these kind of strange shape to them now because we have not done a great deal of, frontline protesting, but we live a few blocks from our mayor's house, and there's some, marching around there every day, and there's a vigil every night, and so that's become something that we try to do, in as responsible a way as we can. I mean, we haven't been sick, and we don't want to get sick, and, there's obviously a lot of other considerations. I'm not trying to get thumped with a nightstick for being on the street at 8:05 p.m. either, but just being inside has felt, it was annoying when it was just a matter of the pandemic, and now it feels, really different and difficult.
Now, the last time you were on, you had pretty strong Trump fatigue, and we all do, obviously, here. So let's focus our discussion from the political world about others, and one is your mayor, who you tweeted about it earlier today. He's found himself a unique place in society that he apparently is held in contempt by both sides.
Yeah, it's really a remarkable achievement. It's not the sort of thing that he mentioned very much during his presidential campaign, soft socialist types on the Upper East Side and cops on Staten Island both think that he's a butthead. Somehow that never came up. But I think it could have been if he decides to restart his campaign to, using the momentum that he's generated by doing such a great job here, maybe that's a message that he could push forward. I tell you, I mean, I voted for him the first time around, and within the first 18 months of his mayoralty, he did some good stuff, did right by kids. There's a universal pre-K program that he ran on and he implemented it. And then, really at that point, he probably should have just resigned. He doesn't seem to like being here. He doesn't seem to like New York City very much, which, again, are relatable things that he was unable to leverage effectively. But he's really just been doing the whole job under protest for a long time, and it's very difficult to make heads or tails of it.
And what are your thoughts on Governor Cuomo?
Boy. In a lot of ways, I don't know. I don't dislike Cuomo more than I dislike de Blasio. Cuomo is a complicated guy. I think that he's a crazy person, in the way that all high-ranking politicians are. And also in some ways that are specific to Queens, that there's a Trump Cuomo Venn diagram overlap of guys that are constantly being why don't you say that to my face? That as a major part of your personal ethos seems somehow unique to being from that part of that borough. But I think the thing with Cuomo that's strange is that his sort of passion for control is not the normal kind of politician's passion for control, that doesn't really have that much of an ideology that I can see, which is good in the sense that he's not a fascist, it could always be worse, but there is this element to him where nothing can happen unless it's happening exactly the way he wants it to and on his timetable. And that's a really bad approach to managing a pandemic and, or civil, disobedience. And it is also, it's been a challenge with this because he hates de Blasio. And so anytime de Blasio does something, Cuomo kind of undercuts him. Anytime Cuomo does something, de Blasio has some little snarky comment about it. So it's, it's a very New York experience watching two wealthy Italian guys have a passive aggressive argument. But it's not the New York experience that Alicia Keys sang about. It's really more when you go to the deli.
Now, a lot of people have suggested that, gosh, the simple way to heal this country and to move on is to get all of the former presidents to speak out together.
Oh, I love it.
And you have found that, is it amusing, naive, ridiculous, or all of the above?
I'll take all of the above on that one, Ben. it's just such a, in some ways, like, it's sort of touching because of the fact that, like, it's sort of, you know, like, Donald Trump is literally the president, right? Like, I know it's a little early in the segment to be bringing this up, but I feel like, you know, most of your listeners have already noticed this. At some point, our reverence of the office of the presidency has to be adjusted accordingly to reflect the fact that Donald Trump is in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that if you somehow just drag enough other guys that you've seen wearing suits and making State of the Union addresses out there, that everyone will remember, you know, how decent we are. None of those guys are president now. And I don't really know that things were, you know, significantly more decent when they were president. They were, I mean, you know, it's a sliding scale, but like mostly it's just that like all of those guys had much better table manners, you know?
All right, let's move to the sports world a little bit, which has got no shortage of bizarre stories and mismanagement and raging egos. Major League Baseball, though, seems to be a uniquely wonderful microcosm of what the rest of the country is up to.
I can't believe that they're really going to screw this up. To me, that seems like the one sport that you could maybe bring back in a responsible way. That, like, the basketball thing, they've talked about the NBA coming back, and it just has that kind of the same vibe to me as people being like, and we're going to do it. We're going to reopen the malls. And, like, you could kind of do that, but you know, all it takes is unlocking the door. It doesn't mean that people aren't going to get sick and that it's not going to be bad. With baseball, I think they had this sort of, like, rudimentary idea of how it could possibly be done safely. But instead of working on that to get it right, it seems like there's just been this endless round of like messaging from the owners and kind of botched similar messaging from the players about money. It's like amazing to find yourself in a position where you're frustrated about the state of baseball when there isn't even baseball to be frustrated at. But it was really, it's been remarkable to me. I saw the owners came back today with a proposal for a 48-game regular season.
Great.
Which, because they don't want to have, they want to have to pay the minimum amount of prorated salaries or whatever. But part of me kind of wants that. I mean, I want any baseball. You know, I've been staying up to watch the Korean baseball organization. Like, I'm pretty much scrounging around in the couch for extra bits of baseball that I might find at this point. But 48 games is wild, man. Like, the Royals could finish in first place if there's just 48 games at random. I mean, it's really, could be a lot of fun.
And then this whole NBA experiment of gathering, if you said it 6 months ago, people would laugh out loud, gathering everybody together at Disney World to play.
Disney World. Incredible. I was on a podcast, a New Republic podcast, like less than a month ago. And that was like the biggest laugh that we all had on it. They had me on to talk about bringing sports back. And, you know, there's only so much you can really say, like it would be nice, but probably not. But someone mentioned that, and like that was even the host that didn't really follow sports were like, well, that is transparently the dumbest possible thing. And yet, I mean, all of these, the plans for bringing stuff back, they all scan to me like the first act of a horror movie, but a slightly different type of horror movie. And so in this one, where it's just like you put everybody in a confined space and there's an invisible thing that hurts people that's there, and then you just see what develops.
Right, it's which players are going to walk into the woods, or which players are going to sneak away and have sex during the party, because either way they're going to end up dead.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like don't run upstairs when you're being chased, Donovan Mitchell. But it's like how it is. Really ridiculous.
We're talking with David Roth on Downtown. Well, I've said from the get go, if there's one sport that I'm confident will have some kind of a season, it's the NFL, because if massive brain trauma doesn't stop them, what's a little pandemic going to do?
They're definitely just going to ignore it. I mean, right. I think that was always kind of the case. And I will say that during these sportsless months, that their dedication to being the NFL was kind of a blessing. Like, it was nice to have a draft. It was nice to have a free agent signing period. It was nice to have another somehow round of Colin Kaepernick related recriminations, like all the stuff that you love about the sport. But again, it's like there's no plan for this. We don't know how to treat or manage the disease. There's not enough testing for it. Like, the idea that you're just gonna roll the dice, like, it's a very football way to do it, where it's just sort of like, we just got to go in there with a positive attitude and attack. And, like, that works if you're playing, like, the Jets. But I don't think it works as well when you're dealing with, like, a super flu that no one understands.
But, Coach, I can't see it. I can't see my opponent.
Right. Well, that's the whole thing. Yeah, so, like, how are you going to intimidate them? You get in their eyes, like, show them that you mean it. But, yeah, it's really – that's the part of it that's kind of, like – I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't think that we necessarily need more coaches in politics. I think probably fewer attorneys, certainly fewer people in their 80s. But, like, one or two old-timey football coaches might actually add a nice sort of, like, a mix to it.
Tommy Tuberville's certainly doing well.
Oh, gosh, yeah. That's incredible, man. I mean, I don't have any real illusions about SEC football coaches as being, like, people that I'd want to have a beer with and talk about whatever, capitalism. But the campaign that he's running down there, it's really, like, I guess this is what Trump kind of does to people's brains, is that, like, in order to show how loyal you are to him, which is really the only, I think, thing that the base Republican voters seem to care about right now, you have to, like, somehow get to his right while sounding kind of like him. And so Tuberville just sounds, it's like scrolling through like an older person's Facebook page and just reading posts. And that's his platform, is like, we're not going to do Sharia law, and also, like, they make the lemonade is too tangy these days, and what's the deal with handicapped parking spots? Like, it's all just, like, salad.
Why can't you get a good pair of penny loafers anymore?
Right, yeah, and I mean, it's hard to say it's entirely the Jews' fault, but yeah, I mean, it's just definitely, like, absolute. It's bold, I mean, like, if nothing else, like, the idea of, you know, all these, I guess, I was never really a great student, but I had the same dreams that everyone has had, the anxiety dreams of waking up and, you know, there's a test that day and you don't have pants and you never studied for it or whatever. The idea of bringing that level of preparation, like literal naked in school on exam day preparation, to running for the Senate is very bold. I mean, it's like, I guess that's why he was briefly a successful coach and then for a longer period of time, a much less successful coach.
Chris Hayes, you were on his podcast. How cool was that?
That was pretty cool. It was good because I didn't have to talk about anything that I don't know about. We were just talking about the Michael Jordan documentary. And that was, I mean, I guess in retrospect, they probably should have just kept making episodes of that because it seems like it was the only thing holding society together. But it was interesting to talk to him. I knew he was a New York person. I didn't know that he was a Gonzo Bulls fan. So it was strange to, like, you know, the guy I respect, and he's a you know, certainly the smartest dude on television. And then to just have, like, a fairly in-depth B.J. Armstrong-related conversation with that guy was a little surreal. But it was good. It was my comfort zone. I could talk about B.J. Armstrong. I just, you don't want to get me started on, you know, things more important than that.
So we've had the Jordan documentary, Lance Armstrong. This is an interesting trend in focusing on incredibly selfish athletes who have never really had much interesting to say.
Yeah, it is a weird one, right? I think the Jordan thing wound up being kind of an interesting document just because of how psychotic Jordan is in it. That, like, knowing that that's his, like, that is his vision of himself.
Right.
Presented. Yeah. And he still comes off, like, it not even comes off, like, bad or good. Like, he comes off like a maniac. Like, just as an impossible, unfinished sort of person. But, you know, presuming that he got the final cut on it, which he probably did, I really would have liked to have known what he saw in it.
Yeah,
Armstrong seems like even wilder. I mean, like, I haven't seen that one, although a couple of my coworkers watched it and liked it.
Man, I found him more interesting, Jordan, than I thought he was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I thought it was profoundly sad. He just seems like such an empty shell of a person who had this obviously incredible drive that just made him push away everybody.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I mean, that, like, it's hard to say, you know, like, who he was or, you know, what you are before you decide that you have to be Michael Jordan. But there is this sort of, like, maybe it's us as people that aren't like that. Not to say that, you know, you are not driven or I'm not, I mean, I know that I'm not, but
I'm not
pretty motivated.
I'm not driven, not talented in my case. That's
but
great.
Well, let's just say that neither of us have the mid-range game that Jordan does. But there's something in that where, like, I see somebody that doesn't seem to take pleasure from the things about being alive that I find pleasurable, or that I think most normal people do, that like family or friends or any of that stuff is just fuel for the, you know, stuff to pitch into the furnace to burn ever, you know, hotter and go higher and all that. And like, I guess I have to believe that that's sad. You know, it's like the like Citizen Kane Rosebud sort of thing where there has to be something that unlocks this person's damage. But also, you know, there are like a lot of elite athletes are like that. I know like Aaron Rodgers is famously like crazily competitive to the point where he'll like, if he's playing ping pong against a kid, he will just absolutely rinse that kid and talk trash. And, you know, if that's what makes him Aaron Rodgers, then, like, I guess he's getting what he wants. But also, like, we know from the rest of his story that he's also chosen not to have a lot of the other things that normal people find comforting.
Yeah, exactly. All right, but we had to get to it eventually. So before we let you go, it's one of the more bizarre weeks in recent American history, but there's always room for more as we go. We have a White House that's barricaded with essentially a secret police force patrolling the streets of Washington. How does this end? How do you see this, especially if the election doesn't go his way come November?
I worry about that last bit. I've been trying to write about the question of how it ends a little bit this week. I haven't really been able to do much in the way of writing. A lot of posting, not a lot of writing. But that question to me is, I think, really important. Like, it feels right now, you know, there's not a real plan for managing the pandemic, which means that there's not any, you know, real responsible way to fully reopen things. I know I don't know what county Bangor's in, but where my father-in-law is in Hancock County, like, they're open. Things are normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're pretty much, as of this week, that way around here.
And I think it's great. It's not like every place needs to stay, you know, battened down forever like that.
Right.
But it's different when it's the way that it is now in terms of at least the way that it is here, that, like, we've more or less got the pandemic to a standstill. Nobody died of COVID in New York on Wednesday, which is the first time that that's been true since the very beginning of March. And that's great. And yet the way that the police have responded to the protest and the way that the protests have responded to the police suggests not just that these are two parties that have a lot at stake here. I mean, my sympathies are with the protesters, if that's not clear, but it's also like, that the idea that, you know, the Tom Cotton idea that we should have troops doing counterinsurgency in cities. I mean, it feels like that's what the cops are basically trying to do here, is counterinsurgency stuff. But we've seen from Iraq or from Afghanistan that, like, while there's tactics for counterinsurgency, there's like things that you're supposed to do, and you can see the cops doing them, you know, like the kettling, they call it, or, you know, whatever, ways to, like, sort of trick people into a confined space so that you can then hit them with sticks. That doesn't solve anything. It's just a thing that you do to manage a stalemate indefinitely. And I don't know, you know, where that leads. Like, I think that the solution to it would be political, because it's not, the police aren't democratically elected. You know, the mayor is. And the governor is, and there's all this money tied up in law enforcement budgets that could be used someplace else. And yet there's no, you know, for all the will on the streets, and I think that a lot of people, you know, would support redirecting some of the hundreds of millions in many cities and billions of dollars in New York to education or social services. There just doesn't seem to be, that doesn't seem to be moving the needle yet. And so it's hard to know. I mean, like, that's the part of it that I think has weighed sort of heaviest on me, is that as inspiring as it is to see people standing up, you know, I haven't seen any real sense of how it gets fixed or any real will to fix it yet. And I don't know what changes that, you know, short of something terrible. So that's hard.
Yeah. Well, on that upbeat note.
Yeah, right. I don't know. Do you want to talk about the NBA again?
We just need to, again, get the Strat-O-Matic baseball game out and drift into the past.
Well, I've heard that Matt Harvey is looking for an opportunity in the Korean baseball organization. So basically, if I wanted to play a Strat-O-Matic team that was just the like 2017 Mets, soon I'll be able to just watch it for real.
There you go. You just have to get up very early to do it.
Yeah, and watch all these guys that I was frustrated by at the time get rocked by Deho Lee or whatever, Aaron Altair. It'll be great.
Maybe Trump will fall in love with the the great North Woods of Maine since he's finally spending some time up there and just want to move to a nice cabin up on Moosehead Lake.
That's someplace, someplace restful. That'll be great. It would be cool if you guys got to, you know, see him just around town. My gritty used to get a six pack or whatever.
He just needs to be on the side of Moosehead where there's no cell service.
Seems like you've got a plan all laid out here.
We may have talked about this in advance. Yes, I'm not denying
it. I was going to say, take that one off air, maybe.
David, always a pleasure for us. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Man. Be well, stay safe, and we'll catch up soon.
Thank you, guys. Take care. Have a good one.
David Roth on Downtown. Bye.